Welcome to Tales from the Creek, where we visit with the people who've made this place special over the years. I'm Stan Cole, class of 1987, and today we continue our conversation with Hall of Fame golf coach John Crooks. To listen to the first part of our interview with Coach Crooks and the other 39 episodes of Tales from the Creek, visit gocamels.com/podcasts. John, in 2001, you won the North and South Senior Amateur Championship at Pinehurst. What's it like to walk into that clubhouse and look at the wall and see your name on the plaque, along with folks like Francis Ouimet, Harvey Ward, Jack Nicklaus, Curtis Strange, Davis Love, on and on and on. And Dwayne Bach as well.
And Dwayne Bach. They used to call that the Hall of Champions as you walk into the clubhouse, and now they've rerouted it a little bit. But the original bronze plaques are still there. And it's just hard to put into words just what a feeling of accomplishment it is when you see, okay, well, this is one of the biggest tournaments in the country, and I won, then my game needs to be pretty good. And because in golf, you never know. Every day's a different day, and we can do is the best we can. And so, yes, it had been a long time since I had competed in anything, and I just kind of wanted to play golf, and then all of a sudden I started playing well, and, you know, at one point I had a 10-shot lead on the back nine the final day, and it just, next thing I know, we were holding a trophy.
You and I have been colleagues for more than three decades, and I can remember you talking to me about that, this is, going on 24 years ago, about that experience. And you told me what your entry fee was, to play, but that you got to play three Pinehurst courses for that. And I thought to myself, wow, even if you're just playing golf, that's a pretty good deal. And then you go out and win the trophy. That's amazing.
I was fortunate.
John, no other person who's been a Division I men's and women's golf coach at the same time has won more tournament coaching titles. That's a combined 162 between your men and women than you are. How have you balanced coaching two teams, John?
Well, you can't do any of it part time. You have to be. Just like I told the administration when I first got started, if you had to put 40 hours in with the men, then you needed to put 40 hours in with the women. And it's just, that's kind of the way I've approached it. I want to spend as much time with both teams. I don't want to show favoritism. I want to help the people who are in the starting lineup. And I want to help the people who aren't in the starting lineup to get in there. And so, we haven't, like right now, every time you have a team, there's or three, four, or five coaches that the NCAA allows per team.
Right.
And we have three for two teams. And so I'm fortunate that Matt has the same outlook and Val has the same outlook in that we have a job to do, and however much time it takes, that's how much time it takes.
John, your first 20 years of coaching at Campbell, university policy did not allow for Sunday competition. How did you assemble a competitive schedule in the 90s all the way up through 2011?
Was it really 20 years?
It really was. The whole decade of the 90s, And then through 2011, right?
I knew when I started that we didn't play on Sundays. And I knew we couldn't compete on Sunday. We could play. We could practice on Sunday, but we couldn't play competitively. And so the story I had to tell was about how many practice putting greens we had, and how good our golf course was, and how many awards that Keith Hills had won, and what a high ranked and how close it was to campus. And so we talked about what we had and not what we didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it didn't take long for other coaches to go to those same prospects and said, yeah, but, you know, they don't play on Sunday. And golf is played on Sunday. That's when the final rounds are. Well, Wendell and our athletic director at the time, Tom Collins,
mm-hmm.
After Wendell, they both saw how the improvement, and they saw how good the teams were getting. And so they allowed me, as the administration did, to play in events where the teams, where they did not compete on Sunday. Well, on the East Coast, you have so many more people than you do on the other side of the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the courses on the other side of the Mississippi River, courses were closed on Monday and Tuesdays.
Right.
So that's where they'd have college events. Mm-hmm. And so once upon a time, I mean, I might cross the Mississippi River three times in a year with a team, just to get to a place where I could find a tournament that was a Monday and Tuesday. And yes, it was a lot of travel, and yes, 54 holes in 2 days is a lot of golf. But that got us the exposure on the national level that we needed. So that if I was recruiting somebody from Montana or from California or from Arizona, they knew of us, and they could compare us to some of the teams that they were a little closer with. And so, look, there were times when I would be in a tournament, and we would get in the tournament because we had to have playing days, and we'd play Friday and we'd play Saturday. And one tournament, Janet had an 8-shot lead winning a golf tournament. And I had to tell the people at the golf course, and then, you know, I had to remind them that we're going to have to withdraw from the tournament. And so she did not get a chance to win that.
Mm-hmm.
She certainly should have. She did her part. They knew about it going in. We dealt with it, and we made the best of the situation.
And I think as a byproduct, your travel budget increased.
I
remember seeing St. George, Utah as a dateline, and Albuquerque, New Mexico. And you're traveling time zones and having to fly all over the country, whereas theoretically you could go from North Florida to D.C. and fill plenty of, you know, at that time. And now you could do that since you do play on Sunday.
That's right.
How has your scheduling changed over the years, John, as your teams have grown in stature and in respect nationwide and opening up? How's your scheduling
philosophy changed? So one of the challenges in today's golf, everything is budget-driven.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to say that I've been in a situation that I could just pick and choose where I wanted to go and where I wanted to play. But Wendell kind of taught me that, you know, maybe with this Sunday deal, we can approve a flight, a semester. And then it got to the point after some success and some championships where maybe we were able to get in another one if it truly was a top-notch Division I for example, I got into Texas A&M.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a flight that we went, and we finished second. And then we took another flight out to Colorado State, and we won there. And when people are seeing that, then Campbell must be somebody. And so now I play, for example, this past year, we were able to play at Clemson. We were able to play at the University of Tennessee. We were able to play at North Carolina State. Well, all of those schools are certainly within driving distance, and there are great teams, and there were great fields. And just by the way, Campbell's record against those three home teams were we had two victories and one tie. So we didn't lose to any of the home squads. It just means that we're pretty good.
John, you've coached teams and individuals in both the NCAA regional and national championships. Your women qualified for the NCAA championship in 97 and back-to-back in 2014 and 15, and that's out of advancing out of the regional. Are there any teams that stand out in your mind as like the best team that just couldn't get out of the regional for some reason, or maybe they were against a stacked field sometimes? I look back and think of, you know, how that 2019 men's team didn't, that group there, 2017-18-19, when Pontus Nyholm was a freshman in 18, and Jesper Svensson was a senior in 19, along with Ray Krivishian and Brett McClam and Max Theodorakis, you had some great golfers back in there, and two of those guys are teeing it up at the highest level possible now.
That's right. And so we have gone to regionals and advanced to nationals. Mm-hmm. And we've had some individuals do that. We've had Sharon O'Neill advanced out of the Ohio State region, and Nadine advanced out of Albuquerque.
And Vida Guillaume won the Greensboro region.
Vida won and won his trip to play Riviera. On paper, the best team I ever coached was not the 97 team that finished 14th in the country. Mm-hmm. It was the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because all of the good players returned, and they were better. And we had both Kylie and Mara. Mara was ranked like in the top 10 in the country, and Kylie was in the top 50. And we went to Duke, and I just thought that we really had a great chance of advancing, and good players didn't play well.
Right.
And so thank you very much. See you next year. And then with Ray and Jesper and Pontus. Now, Pontus' freshman year, he advances.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But the other teams, we would go and we would play at sites that were different grasses or different places. I mean, that's probably more of an excuse than it is a reason. We didn't play well.
Right.
And Matt reminds me that we were within three shots of the lead in 19 at the University of Georgia. And all we've got to do is go out and have a decent day, mm-hmm. and we advance, and we just don't get the job done. So,
John, you've competed and coached on countless golf courses. Do you have a couple or three that are your favorite?
There are two different answers to that.
Okay.
Gary Player said that his favorite golf course in the world is the one he's playing on that day. Okay. And he says the same thing about the greens he's putting, the mm-hmm. greens I'm putting on today. But playing Pinehurst number two, as many times as I've been able to take the team down there and that I've had a chance to play there, that was special. Riviera, wow, everything about Riviera is jaw-dropping. And then just recently, we went the tournament, the golf course, Union National that we played the regional on this past year. that's just something I'd never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I thought we did an exceptional job. We were in it up until the last three holes. And, you know, sometimes five footers go in and sometimes they lip mm-hmm. out. And we just didn't do exceptionally well at the end. We didn't do bad, but we didn't do enough. So,
John, you've been at it a while. How's your coaching style changed over the years? How have you adapted?
Well, this answer is probably in multiple stages. You have to understand that in 1990, Campbell didn't play on Sundays, and Campbell had a very strict policy regarding social behavior and what was allowed and what wasn't allowed. And there was always, you'd hear something about an athlete somewhere that on campus that had kind of done the wrong thing over the weekend. And so early on, I had to have control. Mm-hmm. And early on, I had to make sure that my team knew that we were in a special place and we were making our sacrifices. And I had to come down. I had to be more authoritative then. And then as the years progressed and I improved as a coach, then it became obvious to me that, you know, you can't, all you can do is encourage athletes, and you encourage them to do the right thing. And so, no doubt, young people sometimes make decisions that they wish they hadn't made. And we dealt with it, we moved on, and we tried to do better. And so now I'm fortunate enough in my recruiting now that I kind of know the people that I'm recruiting's background and their parents, and I know from other players what kind of people they are and what their character is like. And so now I can talk about just how good they can be and just how good and what the steps they need to take to kind of expand their games and to get better. And so I read a book that Joe Paterno wrote once upon a time, and he said that if you don't change your coaching style every 5 years, you get left in the dust. And so I've tried to be mindful of the changes that are taking place and tried to go with the flow. Listen, golf's not played today like I played it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I saw a statistic this weekend that Pontus average driving distance on tour this year is 306 yards. And that's like 45th or something. Well, 306 yards back when I started was, you know, they'd sing songs about you if you could hit that far. So the game has changed. The athletes have changed. The expectations, you know, is it harder to recruit now or is it harder to coach now? It's hard to beat a cell phone. You know, mm-hmm. you got to get them rather have a club in their hand than a phone in their hand. But that's the challenge of the day.
John, how about the difference between coaching men and women? Have you learned things from coaching the men that were applied, you were able to apply it to the women, or vice versa?
So the best answer I know to give you is that I'm a member of both golf associations.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go to the men's convention and men's coaches get together, for 3 days, they'll talk about and argue about how the rankings need to be updated and how that needs to, how you need to be able to find a shot and beat it one more team. And you go to the women's convention and they talk about relationships and team building and atmospheres. And so if you take what the women do and filter it over to the guys, the men just love that. They love to be encouraged. They love to be, they love to talk about what's possible for them. And then at the same time, when you talk to the girls, you can't talk to them about beating people. Because if you beat people, that means somebody wins, somebody loses. But you can't talk to them about how they can improve their game, and maybe they can make one more par, or maybe they can make a birdie, or they can make another putt. The stock answer used to be guys all felt like they had a big S on their chest for Superman, and that's the way they approached the golf game. And the women never believed they were as good as they actually were. And so my job was to build one up, and the other one needed to be a little more realistic.
John, you've recruited and coached four players who've reached or will soon compete on the PGA Tour. Let's just chat briefly about each one of those. Start with David Mathis.
So, you know, what people don't realize about David was just his level of commitment to the game of golf. He was looking for ways to do it better before we had all the social media and had all the videos, and he constantly would seek out really good players and watch them and try to learn from them. And David just, and as soon as he got out of school, he did the same thing. The difference was when he got out of school, he could do it 70 and 80 hours a week and not have classes interrupt him. And so he consistently got better. He once told me after he had gone out on tour, he goes, "Coach, I appreciate it when I was playing for you and we would work on my swing and you helped me." He goes, "But the truth is, if you're going to play this game at a high level, if you're practicing on anything other than your putting, you're wasting your time." He said, "And if you go back and just do more of that, that will help the team." And so Brad...
And this is Brad Fritsch.
Brad Fritsch.
He won on the Korn Ferry Tour. He qualified and made the cut at U.S. Opens.
Finished in the top 10 twice at Torrey Pines.
Right. From Canada.
When Brad was in school, we had a young man by the name of Georges Plumet. And Georges was an exceptional player and a great ball striker. Had a lot of really low scores. And Brad was more of a hockey player turned golfer. And it took me a little while. His first year, I didn't see it, but starting his second year, I started seeing what kind of competitor he was. And while George might have been prettier then Brad became more determined, and he kept up with that. One time I heard that they were playing golf and they were playing for a little bit of had a little monetary value. And I kind of pulled Brad aside and I said, "You do realize that George's stroke average is like 5 shots better than you. And you probably, that wouldn't be the one you'd want to jump on." He goes, "Well, he still owes me money." And so that told me so much about the way he approached the game mentally, that the name, and he didn't care who they were. He just knew that he was going to beat them. And he had a great career and still playing and still playing well. Jesper
Svensson. Of course, you've got to tell the story how you got Jesper to come over here.
Well, so I go to the Annika Invitational in Sweden, and I wanted to see I had had the opportunity to coach some Swedes,
mm-hmm.
and what great people they were. I mean, they were just, whether it was Ulf Hedlund or Rickard Allard, I mean, just guys that are Johan or, and I'm not going to mention all their names, but Freddie Sundberg. I mean, just great people. And I go, well, I've never been over there to see them play, and I need to do that because if they're this good and I'm getting what, maybe there's I can get, maybe there's somebody else good too. So the Swedish national team had a meal to introduce coaches to some of the player agents
mm-hmm.
that were kind of helping them with the process of getting into school and doing the NCAA paperwork. And Charlotte came up to me and she goes, I just don't have a girl here that would be on your team, but do I know the men's coach? And I go, yeah, I do. And so she told me that one of her boys that she had just signed had won a big tournament. And I said, well, what was it? She said, well, I'm not sure, but it was they were really excited about his victory. And so the next day she finds me and she says, it was the national match play championship. And I go, yeah, that's pretty big. And so she put us in touch, and nobody had talked to Jesper. He was going to go to play in a division school, do school in Georgia, Clayton.
Clayton State, I
Clayton
believe
State.
It was, right.
And I go, you're the match play champion of Sweden. You're supposed to be playing Division I golf. If you'll come to my place, you'll play all year round. You'll have a golf course that you can walk to, and every single thing you need we'll have. And so he did, and after the first year he went back home and he won more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he went home and he told one of the coaches at his high school that everything he needed to be to improve, we had at Campbell. And so then I've been fortunate that our name is highly recognized in Sweden now.
What made Jesper such a good, and continues to make Jesper such a good golfer? I mean, this guy is a sophomore, goes out and breaks Dustin Johnson's Big South Conference scoring record and wins the conference tournament going away and wins it again his senior year.
When you first see Jesper, you have to realize is that all of these guys are going to hit some good shots. And all of them are going to hit some that aren't good. And Jesper had that unique ability that he remembered the good, he forgot about the bad, and as a college player, the bad never had a big impact on his approach to the rest of the golf course. And that's a level of confidence that most people never can attain. And so he took it. He played here. When he left here and didn't have class, then it was just like he just got better, boom. And now... he's doing some things out there. I mean, this past week at the Colonial, he shoots 29 on the back nine to make the cut. You know, oh, okay, well, thank you very much. And that's like the fourth time he's done that he's broken 30 for nine holes. So he has it. Pontus has it. Pontus practiced a whole lot more than Jesper. And Ponas practiced the same thing every day, working on the same things. And, you know, maybe once a year I would see something that I might mention to Ponas, but he had such a wonderful working relationship with his coach back home that they talked often, they shared videos. Both Jesper and Ponas knew as much about their golf swing when they got here as I do, or as I did about golf. But I also was able to help them because I have played at a pretty high level in my life, and there's certain things that you learn that you can pass on. And I think I was an asset to both of them.
John, let's take a few minutes here, have a little fun, and maybe build a composite of or a list of some of the best golfers you've coached, men's and or women's, and just give a few that come to mind when I list a certain category. Best work ethic.
Mara Lourati.
Okay.
Mara would sit down on Sunday night and plan her week. And this is back when we had the little white house. Was my office, and we had a little tee across the street. And if it was 33 degrees and raining, if Mara had that she was going to work on her long irons, then for an hour she stood out there in the cold weather and she practiced it. And she did it every year she was here, and she did it every week. And she got to be, like I said, one of the top 10 players in the country.
And that's back in a place that field's still there out at the entrance to Key
Right
Hills.
In front of your house.
And you had to pick up your own golf balls there. Right. Nobody was going to drive a little tractor around and collect this. How about your most competitive player?
Probably on the women's side, I would say Callie Pratt.
Mm-hmm.
And Callie taught me something, and that was to really love your opposition. I didn't love the opposition. They were the opponents. And she explained to me that if she didn't have somebody to play against, she'd never be pushed to get better. Mm-hmm. And that was the attitude she brought to her first tournament. And did she compete? Absolutely. And she happened to be on the team with Mara. And Mara happens to be one of the top 10 in the country. And so when we qualified for the Nationals one year, Callie had played 54 holes and had made every putt inside of 10 feet except for one on her 53rd hole.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Do you have any idea how many All-Americans you've beaten this week?" She says, "I know of one I've beaten," and that was her teammate, Mara. And that was on the men's side, you know, some of the best competitors weren't the best players.
Right.
Some of them just got the most out of their golf game. And I've got a name that goes way back. To when Dwayne was on the team. We had a young man by the name of Glenn Pierce. Mm-hmm. And when I took over, he was in the class with Dwayne, but Glenn had another year of eligibility. And I can't tell you how many times that whether it was qualifying or playing in a tournament that Glenn birdied two of the last three holes wherever he was. And so his nickname became Iceman pretty fast. And then thinking about some other players, there's so many, I'll go with those two.
How about, best course management?
Best course management. So, best course management. So, on the women's side, Mara.
Mm-hmm.
She understood angles. And for example, if the pin was in the back right and she was standing on the tee with her driver, she knew if she hit it on the left side of the fairway, she'd have an easier shot with less hazards between her and the hole. On the men's side, when he showed up as a freshman, Eric Johansson was doing things his first semester here that I questioned. You know, you know, you hit a iron off that tee, and you know, why not a 3-wood? And he was, and then he could give me his percentages about why the iron was right. And one day in qualifying, he'd hit a 3-iron off a tee on the fifth hole, and he had an 8-iron into the green when everybody else had wedges, and he made the 8-iron to make eagle, and nobody else made birdie with the wedges. And so, you know, he looked at me like, you know, that's the right way to do it. But the higher up the ladder the people went in the rankings, Alicia Olson, who she was a great course manager. Mira Berglund was a great course manager. Mary Mattson was, she would be in there for competitor and for course manager. And so, look, I've been fortunate to coach over 100 on both sides, and to just pick out a couple of them, you know, I'm talking about people who maybe were the player of the year in the conference, or somebody who went on to play in nationals or turn pro and had some successes. But we didn't win all the tournaments we won because we had the best star there. We won the tournaments we won is because we had five people pulling together and doing the best they could. And so there were many times that the best course planner that day might have been the person who had our fourth score. And that's just the depth and the ability to learn and from the good players is that's that culture I was talking about.
How about longest off the tee? That should be easy. That should be easy to.
Well, the young man from Wilson that was involved in the long driving contest, Paul Howell.
Okay, that's an easy one. That's an easy. He never played around for you, but he was on. But he was on the thing.
I saw him do some things with the driver that you're fortunate to be able to watch it. And now, certainly, Jesper right now is in the top 10 on driving distance on the PGA Tour today. So obviously you have to mention him. Sharon O'Neill was a player of the year, and she graduated, and then she spent a year working as a golf as an assistant pro, and she joined the national long drive contest, and she went to the nationals, and she was long. But there were a lot of tournaments we went to where other people hit it further than she did. And I asked her about that once, and she goes, well, I had it if I needed it. Okay. And so, and she did. And I can think of a 3-wood she hit one day from 250 yards out into the wind at Kiowa, and she knocked it on the greens while some other people were putting out. And she said, well, I didn't think I could get it within 40 yards of the green. But, yeah, she needed to step it up. She could.
for this next category, I'm going to maybe plant a seed for a story, but, and the category, of course, is best short game. And Janet Wooten shared with me a day that she was struggling off the tee, but she ended up with only 18 putts and shot 69. She said, "I would hit it and coach would go find it." What do you remember about that? I mean, that's got to be an incredible short game there.
So different time. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the long ball wasn't necessarily the most important thing. Hitting the ball in the fairway was the most important thing. And early in Janet's career, she was able to hit it a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And so she kind of had to have a pretty good short game if she was going to be competitive. Later on, she wasn't quite as long,
mm-hmm.
but that work she had done on her short game taught her about the short game.
Mm-hmm.
And so she came to Campbell when Dwayne was still around,
mm-hmm.
and she saw how much Dwayne worked on his short game and how good his short game was. And she just became great. I mean, she just pulled it. She had a little sand wedge. And when you pick it up, it was one of the heaviest sand wedges I'd ever picked up. And I often thought that really helped her around the greens to be able to have the touch and feel that she had. So she certainly had a good one. But we've had some other good ones over the years as well.
Can you name a handful of the best putters that you've seen on your teams?
Well, Kelly Pratt wins that hands down.
Okay.
And Mary Madsen would be in there. Young lady by the name of Josefina Usandizaga. Mm-hmm. And Josefina was just, maybe if you don't talk about putting or chipping, if you're talking about just getting it in a hole, she found a way to get it in a hole. Emily Hawkins, you could watch Emily play sometime and go, "Oh, I'm not sure, how did she play?" Well, fair. And what's she shooting? Let me see. 70. So her good was obviously real good, and she understood scoring better than so many people. You mentioned something a while ago about how far Sharon hit it. I can't leave out Anna Nordfors and how far she hit it, because
right.
She took it to a whole new level, and she did it while she was playing, not like Sharon when she
right.
left to hit it further.
John, maybe this one speaks to the culture you talk about that your teams have. How about someone who's the best teammate?
Matt Moot. Matt was really quiet his freshman year. And he just kind of had his head down, and he went out and he won his spot on the team and then played well enough to keep his spot on the team. And it wasn't until sometime in the middle of his sophomore year that I really noticed he might have worked harder in the weight room than anybody else, because he knew that for him to be the best golfer, he had to get a little bigger and stronger and faster.
Mm-hmm.
And he never missed a chance to work out and do the very best he could. On the women's side, best teammate, this is pressure, Stan.
I know this.
this is pressure because every athlete has their own personality,
mm-hmm.
and that personality might have been the perfect personality at certain times to be effective.
Absolutely.
With the team. I don't know that Maria Maldonado didn't always put the team first. I think she did. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't afraid to say something to somebody about getting better. And everybody wanted to be around Alejandra Shaw. I mean, she just had one of those attitudes. I asked her one time, I said, you know, you're a junior. I don't think I've ever seen you have a bad day or be ill. And she said, well, every day I wake up, I get a chance. I can either be happy that day or not. I choose happy. And so they're teaching me. It's not me teaching them.
John, after all these years, what keeps you going?
Somewhere on one of the girls' telephones right now, I recorded a video. And we were playing down in outside of Kiowa, Briars Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And this had been a tough tournament for us. We just really hadn't been playing well. And every one of the young ladies either birdied two of the last four holes or birdied maybe the last hole.
Mm-hmm.
And we went from being not very good on the rankings to jumping up ahead of several division of several Power Five schools, mm-hmm. and that Campbell beat pretty handily. And I said, I'd like for you to tape this sentence. And they did. They recorded it. And when I said, in the recording, I said, I can't imagine that there'll be days that I'll be down. But if that ever happens and we're out playing and I'm not happy, remind me of this moment. Because they had been competitors to the very end. And at the very end, each one of them was rewarded. And if that's not that's why you coach. You see them do that special thing, and they bypassed a lot of good teams, and they made us look really good.
Speaking of coaching, not only has Campbell turned out incredible student athletes during your tenure, but you've built quite the coaching tree. Former players or coaches who followed you in your footsteps at places like Baylor, Michigan, Georgetown, UAB, Charlotte, Marshall, ECU, and I guess we'll say High Point too, the old rival in the Big South. How have you helped those young people and those young coaches learn the ropes?
Depending on who you talk to. Michigan State, Russ Cunningham is there, and Russ told me when he took over he became the Oakland University's mm-hmm. men and women's coach. He said, I just can't coach the way you did. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, bad shots are bad shots. And they need to know that they're really bad shots.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, no, they don't. They kind of know that. If I've taught them anything, and I think you're giving me credit where credit's not due, but the only thing we can control is we can try to get a little bit better
mm-hmm.
the next time we practice. And if you do that enough times, good things are going to happen. And each of those people who went on to head coaching jobs, they found out how when you recruit, yes, talent is important. but character is more important. And yes, if somebody might be the greatest thing since sliced bread, but if they're struggling to pass English or if they're struggling to pass math, they're not going to help us at this level. And so they found the right people to go after. And, you know, all of those people have recruited really good students.
John, last fall, your women's team won the Golf Week Fall Challenge. While that was happening, three of your former assistant coaches were working for other teams there. Ryan Ashburn, head coach at Charlotte, her assistant CeCe Buford. CeCe left here to take the head coaching job at East Carolina. And Lindsey Hunnell, your assistant, is now the head coach at High Point. What is it like when you're out around? Because you see those teams, High Point, ECU, Charlotte, you see them around at tournaments. What's it like to be able to go see them? And y'all have work to do and your golfers to work at. But when you get out at a tournament and you see some people wearing different colors than you are now, and seeing them along the way.
Matt, Stan, it's just a sense of pride. You see how well they communicate and how hard they work and how they're putting their players in a position where they have a chance to do well. And that's all we can do as a coach, I think. And the athletic directors at these other universities that hired these people, they saw what I saw, and they're quality people, and they're very good at their job, and they taught me, and continue to teach me more than. I called Lindsey the other day to ask her a couple questions about the portal, because she's had a lot more success in it than I have. And they're just good people, good coaches.
John, you've been inducted into both the National Golf Coaches Association and the Campbell Athletics Halls of Fame. What do those honors mean to you?
Well, it means that I have to give a speech. And that's not necessarily my cup of tea. I guess I'm my biggest critic, because I know after every tournament, after every round, after every season, you have to go back and you have to reflect on all the things that you did and where did you make your mistakes and what can I do to get better? And, you know, if I made this mistake, what was my reasoning that allowed me to get to that point? And I guess, I think you said 162 victories. I may have played in 1,000 tournaments, so I lost quite a bit more than I won. And it's, you learn from the losses, and you learn how maybe you say something at a different time, or you just show up and smile at a different time. Sometimes this golf at this level is just that. It's just if you can impart a mood, that's what they need to do better. And so me being in the Hall of Fame, I'm honored. Certainly that I think when they inducted me into the Golf Coaches Hall of Fame out in Reno, I wasn't nervous at all until before they gave me my award. They had the other members of the Hall of Fame stand up. And when you look at the people who are in the Hall of Fame and you realize, well, they are great. They are really good. And just for me to be mentioned in that category, I mean, for me to be mentioned in the same voice as Wanda Watkins, Wanda was a trailblazer. Wanda has fought every battle and had been successful, and the number of years she was able to take, I think of what they said about Paul Bryant. Paul Bryant could take his and beat you.
Mm-hmm.
He could take yours and beat you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always the way I felt Wanda went about it. That she just was just a great coach.
I always like to wrap up when I'm talking to my friends in the game of golf with a few golf-centric kind of short answer questions here. Living or dead, who makes up your ideal foursome? And you can make it a fivesome if you need to have four plus you.
I'd have my grandson, my son, my father, and I'd want my wife to be in the golf cart, kind of keeping everybody from fighting.
John, what's the most difficult course you've played?
Well, the most difficult course I've played is Pinehurst number 2 when it's in tournament condition. The greens, the actual putting green, part of the putting green that the ball can stay on, is so very small. And with the new tees that they've put in, it's so long. And it's, it's not a course that the average player would enjoy, I don't think.
How about your favorite golf course?
Well, my favorite goes, it's been a while, down in Isle of Palms, just north of Charleston, is a course called Wild Dunes. And I had a chance to play there on a half a dozen occasions. And it was just, Fazio designed it, and it was almost the perfect design in that wherever you were in the fairway, depending on the pin, it presented a different challenge to you than had you been someplace else. But then the hurricane came.
Mm-hmm.
And they say they lost 10,000 of those big moss-covered oaks. So I went back and played it afterwards, and they did some damage to it. So I don't know that it's the best one right now, but that when the trees were there, that was pretty special.
How about a course that you would like to play?
Well, every golfer wants to go to Augusta.
Right.
But I think I'd just as soon go to Pine Valley in New Jersey. I've got a few friends that are up there, but like Augusta and Pine Valley, if you ask a member to play, the answer has to be no. They have to ask you. So I've still left my options open.
Well, we'll try to distribute this podcast far and wide, and then hopefully that plea will come out and be answered. How about a great golfing memory of yours or memories?
A golfing memory of mine. Well, you know, when you say something like that, then things pop in your head. And I can remember at the age of 15, my buddy and I that played a lot of golf together, Mike Kellum, were playing against the Fenwall boys. And they were twins. And Mike and I were getting ready to go into high school, and the Fenwall boys were getting ready to go to the University of South Carolina and play golf. And we went out and played, and it just was one of those days that if I made a par, Mike made a birdie, and if he made a par, I made a birdie. And we went around for 18 holes, and we beat him on the front, and it got real interesting on the back nine, and I made my first albatross, my first two on the 18th hole. And not only did the brothers get really, really mad, but it took them a while to be able to pay off their debt.
John, how about the best piece of golfing advice you've ever been given or like to give?
The best piece of golfing advice. Well, if it depends on the situation. if it's a situation where I'm trying to help someone with their golf swing, if they're moving their head incorrectly, that would be the first thing I'd talk to them about. If they're standing on the tee, and just because it's a par four or a par five, they pull out their driver, I might talk to them about making another choice. And then the third thing would be you got to pick out a target that is not heroic, but is gives you the best chance of being successful. And, of course, I could go back, and David Mathis once told me when he went on tour, he told me afterwards, he said, Coach, he says, I know you helped us a lot with our swing and being able to play, he goes, but if you're not practicing your putting, nothing else matters. So,
great advice there. Finally, John, can you put into words how Campbell University and the Buies Creek community have impacted your life?
Well, you know, I hope this works as a Campbell commercial, because everything about Campbell is about living to a higher standard. And it's about, you know, you shouldn't drink underage. You shouldn't do drugs underage. Men shouldn't sleep in the women's dorms. Women shouldn't sleep in the men's dorms. There's expectations as far as people going to class. Well, my children went to church right across the street from the school. And the same rules that Campbell had in place, and this is 35 years ago, were things that were very consistent with the church. And so I did, and my wife did, and my children had a chance to hear a great message. And while I have never pretended to live up to everything that I should have done, I can say that it's helped me know the best way to proceed. And there's never been when anything bad goes on in the family, a death in the family or something else, this community just rallies behind you. And I could talk about what neighbors have done and the church has done and the school has done. But just to give an example. So Susan and I have a endowment that we started. And Beth and Jerry Milton also have an endowment in our names that they started. And Campbell found out about my wife's illness, and 2 months before she passed away, they had a luncheon for her in her honor. And so what kind of impact did this place have? It's helped my family. It's helped me. I've met great people, and I'm just a lucky person to be a part of Campbell University.
I'm Stan Cole, and our guest today on Tales from the Creek has been Hall of Fame golf coach John Crooks. Thank you, John, for sharing your Tales from the Creek.
Well, thank you, Stan, and just thank you for what you're doing here. I mean, these podcasts are, sometimes we go back a long way with some of the things, not only for me, but for the other athletes and coaches that you've interviewed, and this is really nice stuff, and it's appreciated.